Thank you. This is from a New York Times article on June 6th of this year, last week. And this is the excerpt. Protesters in Philadelphia stood on the steps of an art museum and demanded cuts to the city's police budget. A crowd gathered outside the Minnesota's governor mansion, stood silently to hear stories from victims of police abuse. At a huge rally in Washington, D.C., demonstrators filled the streets and speakers cried out to ensure that a death like that of George Floyd under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer never happened again. Demonstrations across America that began as spontaneous eruptions out of rage over police violence appeared to have cohered by Saturday into a national mass protest movement against systemic racism marked more by organization and determination than by street fury. And these demonstrations have continued through yesterday. Now, it's staggering, at least for me, when I consider the fact, and I remember in the 60s with Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and that movement, which was enormous. This sounds very similar to that in many ways. And at the same time, we have a pandemic that affects millions and millions of people in the country. So this is all pretty overwhelming. And sort of in the midst of all this, as this is transpiring, I have been sitting with the question of suffering and how do I, as a Zen teacher, how do we as Zen Buddhists respond? How can we respond? How can we reach out and help? So this is what my talk is aiming at. This is a quote from Dogen, who says, "The action of the Buddha takes place in unison with the whole earth and takes place together with all. If it does not include all, it's never the action of a Buddha." So while I was preparing this talk and had been thinking, the poetic image of the lotus flower, which lives in muddy water, right? This beautiful flower, which metaphorically stands for our awakened state. I can even imagine that when the lotus comes up, it's not fully open, but then it slowly opens and becomes awakened in a metaphorical sense. Yet at the same time, this lotus could not bloom and could not exist without the muck, without the muddy water. And the muddy water symbolizes the messiness of life. So we have this beautiful flower living in the messiness of life. And the messiness is the world of desire, of anger and selfishness, political turmoil, social unrest, violence, hatred, prejudice. So those are the two sides. And if we're grounded and open to these conditions, they can bring to life our Buddha nature, the nature of compassion, wisdom, and selflessness. All that's going on has the potential to bring these elements of ourselves to life, if we're open to it, if we allow it to happen. So the lotus and the muddy water, as Dogen has pointed out, are interdependent with each other. And so it means that it includes everything, and everything is the action of a Buddha. Your suffering is my suffering. Whether you're my friend, my family, my sangha mate, or a suffering soul like the Minneapolis policeman or the president of the United States, all of us are interdependent, whether we like it or not. Throughout this, and over time, when I was introduced to the Gate of Sweet Nectar, it slowly becomes sort of my guide, my frame of reference, my foundation. As I take up this question and as I've been practicing over the last number of months. And it's about living the life of a bodhisattva, a life in service of others within the limits of our ability. Each one of us can be a bodhisattva in our own particular way, in our own particular circumstances. There's no one type of bodhisattva. Each of us expresses our nature in our own individual way. And it reminds me to keep my heart open, even in the face of all that's been going on, the challenge, all the suffering, the challenge is to keep our hearts open and realize that each act of kindness, each act of love, no matter how small or how great, affects the whole, everything. So two quick little stories. I think I told one, but this goes back a number of months. I went into Starbucks to get tea one morning, and this young woman comes up and greets me and smiles. And it was just something about her smile. It was so beautiful. It was just a smile, just a simple act of smiling, that I carried that smile with me for the rest of the day. And the spirit of that smile affected everybody that I came into contact with. That was part of how I was presenting myself, through this smile. So this simple act of kindness is like throwing a pebble in the lake. It just kept reverberating out and out and out and out. Most people would say, well, it was a nice smile and like that, but didn't appreciate that that smile just went out into the world. So every simple act of kindness, of love, no matter how small, affects the whole. And then the other story was, I went with my friend Alan. This again is about 5 or 6 months ago. And he was looking for a place to run his 26 marathon. So he found a course in Blacklick, Pennsylvania, which is in the heart of Pennsylvania, which is what we euphemistically call Trump country. And we were driving along and he had a blowout. So we had to pull over on the side. And we went around and opened the trunk, and neither of us really knew what to do, but we knew you had to open the trunk when you had a blowout. So while we were standing there trying to figure, okay, well, I think the tire is under here, a pickup truck drives by with a Trump sticker in the window behind the driver, and it slows down, and the guy inside looks at us and then takes off. You know, so we sort of looked at each other a little uncomfortable. And a few minutes later, the same pickup truck is driving on the other side, going past, again, slowing down to look at us. And now we're getting a little uncomfortable. And again, in a few minutes, the truck has turned around and pulls up behind us. So this was like one of those, uh-oh moments. And the man gets out and he comes up to us and he says, can I help you? So here it is, Trump country, can I help you? And so again, that simple act of kindness, our relationship to that whole way of seeing the world and people who see the world that way was changed, at least temporarily, right? It was sort of heartwarming that this big divide could be closed in just this simple act of helping. And so, of course, we went home and told all the people that would listen this story. But the effect of that was there was at least one person in Blacklick, Pennsylvania, that was not caught into the division between left and right and all the other words that we use. So the reason why I asked Stephen to chant the Gate of Sweet Nectar again is because, as I said, it's becoming part of me. The more I sit with it, the more I chant it, the more I read it, the more I listen to it on YouTube, the deeper and deeper it gets. And the more it happens, I realize how really subtle it is in many ways. And so I just like, just so you have a frame of reference for this, a very brief history of the Gate of Sweet Nectar. Now, these are translations and things that happen through time. So it's not, doesn't, of course, you probably already know this, but it doesn't happen literally. But supposedly it started back in the time of Buddha with Ananda, who was his, I think, a second cousin and was one of his principal disciples. And Ananda, as the story goes, was very close to his mother. And when she died, apparently she was having a number of travails in the afterlife. And it was very upsetting to Ananda because he couldn't do anything. He didn't know what to do. And so he went to Buddha and he asked him for help. And the Buddha, as a way of helping, offered him this service, the Gate of Sweet Nectar. And then through time, in various places, it became a liturgy for people who are suffering. And in Japan, it became used as a service for ancestors. And it's been very adaptable. It has changed to different cultures and different parts of the world. But the spirit of it, I think, has remained the same. And then more recently, as you know, Bernie Glassman became a non-conventional Roshi and started to create all these social programs, started in Yonkers, programs for the homeless, for housing, for employment, the Grayston Bakery. And during this time, he went to talk to Maizumi, went back to ZCLA to talk to Maizumi, because he wanted to use this chant as the basis, as a foundation for his programs, for the people who participated in the program and the people who were recipients of the program. He wanted this to be the philosophy, the underlying spirit of the program. And Maizumi told him that it was okay to adapt this liturgy to his current circumstances. And so you could see there's an evolution of this through time. And my exposure to it recently has been through Bernie Glassman. And so this spirit, the spirit of this chant permeates all of his work, including the social activism, the street retreats, bearing witness retreats, retreats at Auschwitz and South Dakota, a Native American retreat, and all the various programs that have arisen out of his actions. And it actually continues today with the Zen peacemakers. It's chanted regularly. The purpose of the Gate of Sweet Nectar is to raise the Bodhi mind. And that is the mind of the Bodhisattva, which is where we put ourselves before others. And really, it's a liturgy of love. It's a great offering of love and love for this life and all that this life includes. So I like to think of it that way when I chant it or I listen to it, that really it's about love. The heart of it is about love. And as we know from chanting it, it's calling out to all those who are feeling lost or all those who are left behind. And we commit ourselves, our whole selves, to all the suffering in the world. We commit ourselves to work with all the suffering in the world, including the parts of ourselves that we think of as insufficient and lacking, the parts of ourselves that have suffered because we have covered them up and have not extended ourselves to ourself in a loving way. Instead, we have ignored those parts of ourselves. So the Gate of Sweet Nectar is not just about reaching out to all the suffering souls, but we, our own suffering soulness, if you will. So we offer the Bodhi mind, the awakened mind of love, wisdom, and transformation. And that's the spirit of this chant. And for me, it's a reminder to remain open-hearted, which is the same thing as saying to be loving, and to continually, over and over again, let go of anger or hatred that may arise for various circumstances, particularly these days with all the different forms of social unrest and also the mass sickness that occurs. So when we do this chant, I guess I would ask that you let it touch your heart. Be still, just hear the sound and the words and let it touch your heart. It's really a beautiful chant. And as I said, very deep and very subtle. And I would encourage you to chant it, to read it, to sit with it, to study it. And if it resonates with you, to make it part of your daily practice. So again, thank you for listening.